All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. It is 5 o'clock, 5:01. Definitely time to get this session started. Thank you for attending session 375, titled Mormon Magic and the Religious Worldview. Before we begin, we ask that all cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6, at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. Of course, this is the last session of the day. Hopefully you caught that by now. Sunstone is over now, unless you're going to the barbecue. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after the session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations that will not be happening can begin preparation for the next session. Okay. This session consists of 3 separate presentations. Alan Hansen, his addresses Finding Treasure and Other Wealth in Jewish Tradition, fits the spiritual schema of redemption. By examining folklore, responsa, etc., lessons can be drawn to better understand Mormonism. Cheryl Bruno's presentation, Alchemists were a necessary agent of creative transmutation, a priest in a hallowed ancient priesthood, a son of the widow, a knower of creation's ancient secret, a digger after hidden treasure. England will be a focus. And New England will be a focus. Forget the old England, we don't need it. Finally, Michael G. Reed's presentation, Vicarious Work for the Dead, particularly among German and other Christian treasure seekers, as the granting of 3 wishes freed an otherwise trapped genie, it's got 2 eyes, treasure guarding spirits could be freed from their trapped / limbo state. Presenters will speak in the following order. Alan Hansen served in the Russia Rostov mission and later moved to Utah, and alongside a love for literature, especially British, Russian, and Israeli, his research interests include Mormonism, Judaism, biblical studies, late antiquity, journalism, Eastern European, and Middle Eastern history. He has presented at the Mormon Scholars in the Humanities Conference and is currently pursuing a bachelor's degree in journalism from USU. Cheryl Bruno is an independent scholar of Mormon history. She has published articles, spoken at conferences, and is co-author of The Method Infinite, Freemasonry and the Mormon Restoration, forthcoming from Greg Cofford Books. Cofford, right? It's Cofford, sorry. Michael G. Reed is a doctoral student. I cannot talk today. Is a doctoral student at Graduate Theological Union, Berkeley. He is the author of Banishing the Cross, The Emergence of a Mormon Taboo, John Whitmer Books, 2012. Our panel.
Oh, good evening. Very nice to be here. So my topic today is going to touch on several issues, which Mike and Cheryl will go into further detail on some. Now, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a bit of an odd duck in the Christian world. We unabashedly embrace a corporate outlook in almost everything that we do. Need I say white shirts, suits, missionary goals, meetings, and not to mention that across from the temple here in Salt Lake, one, you have a church office building, and you have the City Creek Mall, which the church helped fund and everything. Not entirely surprising, then, that an indispensable volume on Mormon history, at least in my opinion, is Leonard Arrington's Great Basin Kingdom. And that one goes into a lot of focus on economic history. That's the thrust of the book. basically, throughout our Mormon history, you find a focus on the material. And I want to look at one of the contributing factors to that, which is the magical worldview. Now, magic, I feel, is a term simultaneously unhelpful and indispensable. We all get an idea of what magic means, and it's probably wrong, but it's a good place to start from. There's just nobody's been able to find a term that covers it better. There's ritual power, there's enchanted worldview, which I prefer, but still, that's rooted in magic, so you can't escape the connotations entirely, not even there. So I want us to think about the term magic before proceeding a little bit, leave our negative opinions at the door, and just feel like this is what people believed, how it helped them get closer to God. Now, I grew up in northern Israel at the foothill of Tzfat. Once this was one of the most influential centers of Jewish spirituality and religious scholarship. Modern Kabbalah is rooted in Tzfat, teachings of Isaac Luria. Now, in the early 90s, a little bit past its glory days, the city was the cultural center of the small Anglo-speaking community. Now, cars are not that common, so we frequently help people get there and back. On one such drive, a person traveling with us surmised that the piles of rocks strewn across the hills were caused not by geological movements, but by Napoleon's soldiers who shot up the hillside with cannons because they were trying to find the hidden temple treasures. It sounded crackpot then when I was, like 9 or so. And I still dismissed rock slides as evidence of that sort of thing. But a couple of years later, I found the legend in a book called, Zev Vilna's Legends of Galilee, Jordan, and Sinai. It's first recorded in the 1860s by a man named Moshe Reise, who traveled the 1840s and 50s throughout the land of Israel. He recorded a lot of traditions in order to encourage people to emigrate and feel a connection. And he writes, "The Emperor of France, Napoleon, was in Palestine about 50 years ago. And from ancient chronicles, he learned that in the mountains of Ein Kachal are hidden the precious vessels of the temple. And he and his men went to the mount of Ein Kachal, excavated almost half the hillside, but all in vain. For he did not know that only with the advent of the Messiah will these treasures be revealed unto the children of Israel." So it's not quite Tzfat, it's a little bit outside it, and not quite canon, but it's an old legend. Now, the ancient chronicle is the treatise of the vessels. The history and composition date of the text are complex, they're shrouded in uncertainty, but there are striking parallels to the copper scroll found at Qumran, and strongly suggests its antiquity. Both are lists of treasure hidden by Levites and priests. The copper scroll is about the Roman destruction of Jerusalem. The treatise of the vessels ascribes it to a much earlier period, the Babylonian conquest. And it shows how 5 Levites and prophets went and hid the temple vessels, all the gold and everything, in various places. This was first printed in the 17th century as part of the Kabbalistic scholar Naftali Bacharach's treatise on Lurianic Kabbalah, Emek HaMelech. It was an extremely influential volume. 200 years later, Jelinek published a longer recension, and in the 20th century, Milik, one of the scholars who excavated at Qumran, curiously enough, published a third text from Lebanon inscribed on marble. No one knows what happened to the marble. But again, it relates how treasures were hidden, and the idea of Napoleon digging up the countryside in search of ancient treasure is not entirely implausible, at least far less than it would seem. And there is a certain logic behind the creation of this legend. First and foremost, few figures in the early modern world have exerted such a pull on the Jewish imagination as Napoleon. Even Mormonism, you might be surprised, has its own Napoleon Jewish lore. Alexander Nybar's father was said to be a physician and interpreter for Napoleon. There's dozens of such legends, Some are true, some are spurious. So it'd be nice to find independent confirmation of such. At the moment, we don't have that. But Napoleon reorganized a Sanhedrin, a Jewish council, held a generally positive attitude towards Jews, and pushed for their emancipation in territories he held. As Martin Buber masterfully depicted in his novel Gog and Magog, Napoleon polarized Jewish opinion so much that even close friends became enemies, especially once he went and invaded Russia, because that was towards the largest concentrations of Jewish population. Some, you see, were convinced that Napoleon was a good thing, even a divine agent, who would herald the end of persecution. Others were equally certain that Napoleon would lead Jews to assimilate and desert their faith, and that men must not hurry the time of redemption. So this explains in part the Jewish fascination with Napoleon, but in 1798, he invaded Egypt. His objectives, though he wanted to take Egypt and disrupt the British route to India, his objectives were not purely military or political. A contingent of around 150 scholars and artists accompanied Napoleon, and they set about uncovering all they could about ancient Egypt. The very fact that we can read ancient Egyptian inscriptions is because the scholars brought back the Rosetta Stone, among others. And modern Egyptology is rooted in the findings of this expedition. But why did he invest not only in bringing 150 men, but also all the equipment they would need, horses, transportation, bring back? Europe has always been fascinated by Egypt, especially since people began to be fascinated again by the Hermetic corpus in the Renaissance. And part of Napoleon's goal was to create a larger new culture and draw upon the past. So there was this interest in ancient Egypt and what it could tell, ancient records in general. In fact, many of the expedition later became part of an order called Sophistines, which is another similar to Masonry. I'm sure there's several here that can go in more to that, but you have all these ideas about Napoleon looking for ancient things, and when he went to the land of Israel, why not there? So that's where the legend comes from. But last but not least, the legend serves to cement the idea found in the treaties that the temple treasures were reserved for the righteous in the days of the Messiah and could not be found if sought for any other aim. So not even Napoleon himself could find the treasure, no matter how hard he looked. And at the very end of the treatise on the vessels, that point is made, so it's not original to the author, but the point is made. And which he had. So goes and lists, all these did Zedekiah hide, and no one knew where they were hidden until David will arise. And all the silver, gold, and precious stones will be delivered into his hands, when all Israel from the four corners of the world will come in strength to the land of Israel. And the river will rise up and join with the Euphrates and wash up all the treasures. So this is something that is done for the benefit of the Lord's people when the days of the Messiah approach. It is entirely wrong to think of the Messianic era as a big dramatic event. There's lots of that in the apocalypses, especially Jewish ones, but they imagine the life as usual. But a perfected life, one where everyone will be able to live as they should, harvest. In the Bible, they draw on the image of every man under his fig tree. And of course, because life continues, you're not going to live destitute. You're going to need funds. So the Lord has things hidden in the earth, which the righteous will find in the Messianic era. And then this is not just theoretical, but actually in the later half of the 17th century, when there was the Messiah Sabbatai Tzvi. He was born in Turkey. He felt that he was the Messiah. He began to attract lots of disciples, pretty much most of the Jewish world for at least a year or two believed that he was the Messiah. And his prophet, Nathan of Gaza, decreed that no one should accept any funds coming in from outside the land of Israel. People relied on communities elsewhere, so Poland, North Africa, Yemen, to send them the funds that they needed. There was very little agriculture or anything like that. So Nathan of Gaza decreed that there would not be any because all the treasures would soon be gathered to the land underground in order to be used. And he drew upon a book written about a generation before he was born, so that as for the underground treasures, the earth will form subterranean passageways so that all the royal treasures can be miraculously moved to Palestine. All of the treasures hidden in the sand. So this trope of slippery treasure is very common. Again, we meet it in early Mormonism. But here it is something divinely decreed, emente the Messiah. And because people were expecting all these riches in places like Yemen, they started either giving up their businesses that they had and just boasting that they'll soon be rich and take over everything that their neighbors had. It caused expulsions, persecutions, just like we see in Missouri, same attitude towards Messianic era. Now, onto another aspect of this. There is a very old story type, which we can call the treasure under the bridge. A version of it appears in the Talmud, another in the 1001 Nights, other places throughout the world. It's possibly alluded to by Rumi as well. Essentially, someone has a dream saying that if you travel to a large and distant city, sometimes Vienna, sometimes Prague, you'll find under the bridge a treasure. Because the bridge is hardly abandoned, the person cannot simply dig underneath it. After a while, he decides to confide in someone, maybe get some help, and the person, who is typically a guard, laughs at his foolishness and says, "Why, I had a dream just like that. If I were to travel to a certain city, I would find treasure buried in the home of so-and-so." Both city and name are the dreamer's own, so he goes back and finds a treasure right there under his nose, basically. The story was extremely popular in Judaism, nearly 50 variants known in it alone. The Hasidic movement especially used this in their spiritual instruction. Now, they were a movement that formed in the 18th century with specific attitudes to prayer and relation, all sorts of that. But one of these is particularly interesting, and it starts as a tale of Rabbi Isaac, Rabbi Yekidish of Krakow. Poland built the synagogue in Krakow called the Rabbi Isaac, Rabbi Yekidish Shul. Now, he had a recurring dream that he should travel to Prague, and there, under the bridge by the royal court, he should dig and find a great treasure which will make him rich. It's like traveling to Canada from here. He traveled to Prague and went to the bridge by the royal court, but it was patrolled by soldiers day and night. He was afraid to dig in the ground for treasure, but because of his sorrow at having to return home empty-handed after such a long, arduous journey, he paced back and forth by the bridge. So he's walking along, and then the head of the guard sees him, takes pity on him, asks him, what are you doing here? So Rabbi Isaac decides that maybe he can get some help, and he tells him that he had this dream about finding treasure under the bridge. And he gets told, you're foolish. You're wasting your time. What would happen if I were to chase every single dream I had, like the one about someone called Rabbi Isaac and Kaka who has treasure under his oven? So he gets that. He heads back. He digs under that. Finds the treasure. And with the treasure, he goes out and builds an enormous synagogue. One that I believe is still standing. Now, the legend itself is rooted actually in medieval England, where there was this wealthy Jewish man who was tortured by the English and forced to give up treasure they said he found in a dream, and they used that to build a church. And they actually have a festival there apparently every year. But the interesting thing about this story is also the context. So we have it printed in the early 20th century. It persists that far, but it was apparently a very popular story that every Levi Hasid, who followed Particular Rebbe, and then his, going back to Rebbe Simcha Bunim of Pzishucha, who died in 1827, they were all told the story before they would travel to their master. Now, the relationship between a Hasid and his master, the Rebbe, is the key. The Rebbe is, again, to use an image, he's the bridge between his followers and God. And he has a responsibility to take care not only of their spiritual needs, but their material ones. And everyone who would go on his first visit would hear this story, so he'd learn that the treasure that you're seeking, you have to look inside. So it's used as a spiritual metaphor. But the surprising thing here is that's the secondary meaning. The primary meaning of the story is that there are riches out there, and they're meant to be used for a purpose, what we'd call building the kingdom of God. In this case, he needed a synagogue. Dreams are a form of prophecy in Judaism. Lesser, but still a form of prophecy. They are sent by God either as a warning or a promise of something to come. Rarely, if ever, were dreams simply dismissed as overwrought imagination in the traditional world. Eminent rabbis even sought dreams as answers to important questions of law. If we encounter a dream in a traditional Jewish source, it needs to be treated seriously. So in the various versions of this tale, God reveals the presence of treasure. Why reveal it if he does not want it found? And why have someone find it if it is not to be used? The dream amounts to the divine imperative to engage in treasure seeking. And then, about the same time as Hasidism, a bit earlier, there's this man in the same area called Jacob Funk. Now he was contemporary of Casanova, Cagliostro, and quite a few of the charlatans. The unique thing about him is that he believed that he was the Messiah, and he formed a syncretist religion that incorporated elements of Judaism and Islam, and even paganism, and adopted quite a bit from Masonry and other secret lodges. He had his followers convert to Christianity. It was a huge scandal in the Jewish world that caused a lot of bad blood for about 200 years. Now, we need to drop the complete negative implications of the term charlatan. Yes, this 18th century type often swindled those who sought his help, more often than not, and abused power in pretty much any way possible, but it is a mistake to see the charlatan as an opportunist only. Charlatans did have a sincere belief in their power and unique abilities. If something didn't work out, they were well prepared with a contingency to make it work. But they were serious about the pursuit of hidden knowledge. And there's a book of his stories and aphorisms called The Words of the Lord, known in the Polish version. There's at least 100 references to treasure just in that. He rebukes his disciples for not following him into prison. He said if they would, they've been with him for some time there, and he had released them to go find treasure, and the treasure that would serve to advance their purposes. So no matter the form of Judaism, you keep finding this positive attitude towards treasure. The more messianic it is, the stronger the need to get the treasure and to bring about redemption and other goals. And a lot of this centers, unsurprisingly, in Germany. Judaism influenced the world a lot, but also was influenced by its surrounding cultures. In the 15th century, there's an account of rhodomancy, of how to use a divining rod. On Midsummer night, after sunset, go to a year-old hazel tree and select 4 rods which grew that year. Bind them together and grasp them in your left hand while you pass the right, in which you have placed gold and silver coins, 3 times around them and recite this. May these rods be as successful as our father Jacob's were, for when the flock beheld them, they bore young in their likeness.
May these rods as surely reveal to me hidden treasures, whether of coin or valuable objects or jewels. I conjure you by the name of El Shaddai, the Rock of Ages, by the name I Am That I Am, by the name of Him Who Knows the Future, by the name of Michael, Kutiel, Luel. Leave the silver and gold there, and in the morning before sunrise, go to these rods and cut them in the direction of the sun, and in the directions of the four cardinal points, east, west, north, and south. And as you cut each rod, say, and there's a spell in Jewish dialect of German, predating Yiddish. But the interesting thing here is we see all the magical elements, magic names, but we do need to note by what names the deed and the spell are done. And here's a continuation of that. I conjure you by the living God. I conjure you rods by the true God, by the holy God, that from this moment you bend toward the spot where this treasure is concealed. Gershom Scholem wrote that the magic quality of the name relies on the fact that a close and substantial relation exists between the name and the name's bearer. The name is a real, non-fictitious quantity and contains a declaration about the nature of its bearer, or at least something of the potency attaching to it. It is further identified with the nature and essence of what is named by it. So when he's relating all these names of God, he's using this by the power of God, by what that's how he pictures it, not by some dark force, but actually by the power of God. And he relates here the story of Jacob when he cut rods in order to make his flocks breed more and surpass what his father-in-law Laban had. So he's connecting it to the same stories that we read in the Bible. And the spell is pretty much taken over entirely from German Christian sources. So you have this common thread running throughout, and as Mike and Sherlo show, it keeps going down to the 18th and 19th centuries and influencing Mormonism. How much time? All right. So I'll just finish with this. Treasure hunters, whether pious or not, often pursue treasure with the sincerest of religious convictions. It encountered significant resistance from the religious establishment, for want of a better term. In Judaism, there does not seem to be such institutional opposition to treasure seeking as long as the motive was spiritual. Quite the contrary, we see treasure tropes as part of a broader religious narrative of how God relates to his children. Thank you.
Well, Ellen talked about the magical background which was inherited by Mormonism. Especially, I enjoyed the story of the treasure under the bridge because it shows how treasure was used as a spiritual metaphor. So I'd like to connect this background now with Mormonism. So I'm going to start with Adam, the first man. By the sixth century of the Common Era, Adam was considered to have been fashioned of the four elements, earth, water, air, and fire. All of these suffused with the life-giving quintessence, or the fifth element of spirit. After his expulsion from paradise, he became subject to the various impurities of the animal creation. Human life was soon reduced to a very brief span. In later ages, Adam became not only a product of primordial divine alchemy, but the first recipient from God of the secrets of the great art, which were then transmitted from him to Noah, Aaron, and all the other prophets. Thus, by the 16th century, alchemy could boast of a complete biblical genealogy, and the alchemists were able to claim that they were the inheritors of a secret science of biblical and divine origin. Oops. Alchemy was the medieval forerunner of chemistry, based on the supposed transformation of matter. It was concerned particularly with attempts to convert base metals like lead into noble ones like gold. Other common aims were the creation of an elixir of immortality, the creation of panaceas able to cure any disease, and the development of a universal solvent. But what many people do not realize is that as it was practiced in medieval Europe, Egypt, and Asia, alchemy was a philosophical as well as a proto-scientific tradition. Michael Sendivogius, a 17th century alchemist, remarked, "It may be asked how I come to have this knowledge about heavenly things which are far removed beyond human ken. My answer is that the sages have been taught by God that this natural world is only an image and material copy of a heavenly and spiritual pattern, that the very existence of this world is based upon the reality of its heavenly archetype. Thus, the sage sees heaven reflected in nature as in a mirror, and he pursues this art, not for the sake of gold or silver, but for the love of the knowledge which it reveals." This is the whole basis of alchemy for these sages. "The philosopher's stone was the most sought-after goal. It was the central symbol of the mystical terminology of alchemy, symbolizing perfection at its finest, enlightenment, and heavenly bliss. Efforts to discover the philosopher's stone were known as the magnum opus, great work. The perfection of the human body and soul was thought to result from the alchemical magnum opus, and in the Hellenistic and Western tradition, the achievement of gnosis." So a favorite saying of the alchemist was, "What is above is as what was is below." As Sendivogius wrote, "The bodily nature of things is a concealing outward vesture." So to put this quite simply, the alchemist's quest to turn base metals into gold was symbolic of their efforts to perfect their worldly human personality, inherited by Adam, into something more divine. The true goal of alchemy was not to get rich. It was the transformation of the human soul. Alchemy was firmly associated with the Christian tradition. Many stories found in the Bible use the idea of transformation of earthy substances to imply a more spiritual meaning, and thus appealed to the early alchemists. At the marriage in Cana, Jesus performed the miracle of taking a common element, water, and turning it into wine, a more spiritual substance. This occurred at the beginning of his ministry. Nearing the end of his life, the Savior gave bread and wine to his disciples in a sacramental representation of his own body and blood, which would be offered in sacrifice. In each of these actions, Christ was the divine agent of transformation. So Christ was the philosopher's stone in these stories. The success of any alchemical operation depended upon the purification of the alchemist himself. He was an essential component in his own operations. Any success was a signal that the alchemist was attaining purification. Lance Owens, a Mormon writer, discussed the importance of human transformation in the medieval alchemist's work. They said, "Our gold is not vulgar gold." They were hoping to acquire something more than mere material wealth. Poetically, Owens calls each alchemist a necessary agent of creative transmutation, a priest in a hallowed ancient priesthood, a son of the widow, a knower of creation's ancient secret, a digger after treasure. So this son of the widow, of course, is an allusion to Freemasonry. Following the Renaissance, the fraternity of Freemasons arose with a keen interest in Hermeticism and the legacy of the alchemists. Alchemy, an early esoteric psychology, observed processes in nature which could teach or reveal things about the human nature. Masonry further developed this theme. Symbolic traditions and Masonic rituals pointed to their interest in the perfection of human personality. An unfinished stone in the northeast corner of the lodge, called the rough ashlar, was representative of the human being in his natural state, barely separated from the common mass. Their goal was to polish their base nature and become more like the smooth ashlar on the opposite side of the lodge. In this degree, digging deep in the earth was a metaphor for seeking deep within themselves. From the first appearance of the Royal Arch degree in the late 1700s, mention of the search for a lost treasure was integral. royal arch treasure took the form of the Ark of the Covenant, a key, a sacred word, a plate of gold. All pointed to some redeeming or perfecting power. Treasure was truth, a new way of seeing the world, an understanding of the worth of the individual and what he was really capable of. While the Royal Archmasons were refining the Hermetic tradition in their lodges in Scotland, France, England, and in colonial America, where it caught on early, another practice reached its zenith in Vermont, New York, and other colonies. Ron Walker explains. From colonial times to at least the age of Jackson, Americans dug for magical treasure. There were hundreds and probably thousands of these money diggers, all seeking troves of fabled coins, mines, jewels, and other valued prizes. They worked from the Atlantic coast to the Mississippi hinterlands, and in a few localities heaped up tailings that rivaled those of the later 49ers. Yet, for all this prodigious toil, their finds were as rare as Merlin's transmuted gold. What made them persist? Relying on an immemorial but now forgotten worldview, the money diggers placed faith in conjuring elemental spirits, thrice spoken dreams, seeric gifts, an enchanted treasure that could slip and rumble through the earth as easily as a fish moving through the deep. The modern age will probably never fully understand the diggers' strange compound of treasure seeking, religious feeling, and intense psychological devotion. Theirs was another world which we can speak of but hardly enter. So I'll let you read Walker's article for his reasons on why early Americans dug for buried treasure, but this is a fascinating question, and my view is just a bit different from his. It's very similar to what the alchemists and the Freemasons were doing. First, we see that treasure seeking was an esoteric folk belief deeply connected with religion. One example of this is the German pietist Johannes Kelpius. On the outskirts of Philadelphia, he founded his Chapter of Perfection, a religious brotherhood that mixed alchemy, astrology, the Hermetic arts, and money digging with millennial Rosicrucianism. After his death, Kelpius's influence continued in the communitarian Ephrata settlement and in a series of magic practitioners who mirrored his own interests. In the woods between Philadelphia and Germantown, the small band of seekers known by residents of Germantown as Weib in der Wüst, the Society of the Woman in the Wilderness, devoted themselves to lives of simplicity, poverty, celibacy, prayer, and the study of numerology, astrology, and alchemy. Settling along the Wissahickon Creek, the group built a 40 by 40 foot tabernacle, that's a cube. On the roof of the tabernacle, the monks erected a telescope they used to scan the heavens for signs of Christ's return. That would be in the 1700s, late 1700s. Michael?
Yeah.
Michael's going to talk a little bit about them, too.
So,
a little closer to Joseph Smith, physically, was the Nathaniel Wood Group. You've probably heard of them, a quasi-religious association organized around the nucleus of Wood's large family. The family patriarch was a would-be preacher and excommunicant of the Congregational Church. The group was located in Middletown, Rutland County, not far from the Smith family homestead. Known as the Fraternity of Rodsmen, this band of mystics had several beliefs derived from Masonry, especially the craft's Royal Arch tradition. Wood's followers began using divining rods to obtain the mind of God. Wood had received a revelation that they must build a temple, an esoteric practice rooted both in the Bible and in Masonic tradition and allegory. As a religious exercise, the Wood group also made excavations in local mountains from which valuable ore was to be taken. The notion of an underground treasure recalled the subterranean cavern of Masonic legend wherein lay the golden plate of Enoch. also reminiscent of the royal arch tradition, Wood instructed his followers that they were descendants of the ancient Jews and lawful inheritors of the whole county, and that the divining rods would designate who they were. Further, royal arch masonry connects Aaron's rod, which budded, blossomed, and brought forth flowers in a single day, with the concept of restoration. Jacob Wood, the son of Nathaniel, was known as Priest Wood, and he was the leader in the use of the rod. Here's a quote. "He was the man to find where the money was buried and to use the rod at their public meetings and on other occasions, though all the Woods and their followers had each a rod, which was used whenever they desired any information. If anyone was sick, they sought the rod to know whether they would live or die and to know what medicine to administer to them. In all their business manners, they followed, as they said, the direction of the rod, and with it they could, as they pretended, divine the thoughts and intentions of men." So overall, the Wood congregation, like Helpius's group, was a remarkable manifestation of folk belief and increasing religious pluralism. Their belief in an imminent apocalyptic event on January 14, 1802, combined with their militant fervor, led to an incident known as the Wood Scrape. The Wood group claimed that they would gain possession of the entire region of the countryside when the destroyer passed through and slew the unbelievers. And then here's this quote. This is talking about the Wood group, not the Mormons. "The Latter-day Saints were about to be gathered. They would build a holy city, the New Jerusalem, somewhere in this country, and they would have enough gold to pave the streets." The furor surrounding their pronouncements became so intense that it is unfeasible to maintain that the Smiths were not aware of it. They lived very close to where this was going on. Indeed, it has been suggested that both Joseph Smith Sr. and William Cowdery, fathers of two of the founders of the Latter-day Saint movement, were directly involved with the Wood group. D. Michael Quinn theorized that a connection between William Cowdery and the Wood Scrape would help explain why his son Oliver had a rod through which he received revelations. One simply cannot understand the Wood group or early American treasure seeking without understanding the larger context and the earlier model of alchemy. Their money digging and use of a divining rod were connected with folk religion and had a symbolic spiritual meaning, which made the practices attractive to spiritual seekers. The participants viewed their activities as a genuine expression of Christianity. Treasure digging in early America generally followed various ritual requirements. One such requirement was the presence of a young boy who was pure. Often, magic circles were drawn around the site of the dig, or celestial beings were summoned. However pagan these things appeared, historian Keith Thomas concluded that their activities were fundamentally religious. Prayer played an essential part, Thomas observed. Piety and purity of life were deemed essential. At this level, the practice of magic became a holy quest. The search for knowledge, not by study and research, but by revelation. Johannes Dillinger wrote of additional ritual requirements associated with treasure seeking. According to this belief, the soul of a deceased person had to wander until a certain task he had failed to fulfill during his lifetime was complete, or some guilt had been expiated. It was supposed that when treasure seekers took possession of the loot with an intention of using a portion for a positive purpose, its guardians would be released from their captivity. This activity fulfilled the Christian responsibility to save souls. Legends, dreams, and visions served as religious revelatory means of locating the treasure. Okay. Dillinger saw 19th century treasure seeking as a deeply Christian ritual, serving a dual purpose of assisting in the work of God and reaping economic prosperity. Thus, the operations of early American treasure seekers had similar goals to that of medieval alchemists and Enlightenment age Freemasons. Digging for buried treasure was a spiritual quest. For Latter-day Saints, this quest is important because the buried treasure that the young Joseph Smith eventually recovered was the Book of Mormon. The angel who led him to the golden plates upon which this book was written specifically forbade Smith from using the treasure he found for monetary gain, but charged him to use them for the purposes of God. Once the book was translated, it was consistently referred to as a treasure. Oliver Cowdery called the Book of Mormon a sacred treasure. Brigham Young also later referred to the record as a treasure. The first Mormon hymnal, compiled by Emma Smith, contained these verses. I wish I could sing them. I don't know the tune. A heavenly treasure, a book full of merit, it speaks from the dust by the power of the Spirit. A voice from the Savior that saints can rely on to watch for the day when he brings again Zion. Early Mormons viewed the plates as a treasure because of their spiritual, not their economic value. There's Oliver Cowdery, Brigham Young, and Golden Plates. Okay, so the perfection of human personality via the transformative and redemptive power of Christ is a central theme in the Book of Mormon and is emphasized in its closing chapter. Moroni entreats, come unto Christ and be perfected in him. Notice that this scripture makes Christ the agent of perfection and thus the philosopher's stone. Joseph Smith continued to seek for treasure at various times throughout his ministry and succeeding the period of time when he was a callow youth. I kind of skipped over the times when he treasure dug when he was a teenager, because I'm assuming that most of you are very familiar with these. But later on, he was continuing to seek for treasure. One instructive example occurred in August of 1836. Joseph was 31 years old now. He and several brethren traveled from Kirtland, Ohio to Salem, Massachusetts to search for treasure. According to Ebenezer Robinson, a brother by the name of Burgess stated that he had knowledge of a large amount of money secreted in the cellar of a certain house in Salem, which had belonged to a widow then deceased, and thought he was the only person who had knowledge of it or the location of the house. So the brethren all traipse over to Salem, and then Burgess disappears. Here's a little letter. You probably can't read it, but it's from Joseph Smith to Emma, talking about their adventures in Salem. In the Millennial Star was written an account of the brethren's activities. Here's what they did: preaching publicly and visiting sections of the surrounding country, which are rich in the history of the Pilgrim Fathers of New England, in Indian warfare, religious superstition, bigotry, persecution, and learned ignorance. Here Smith received a revelation which is now found as DNC 111. It says, I, the Lord, am not displeased with your coming on this journey, notwithstanding your follies. I have much treasure in this city for you, for the benefit of Zion, and many people in this city whom I will gather out in due time for the benefit of Zion through your instrumentality. For there are more treasures than one for you in this city. So, the treasure here in Salem ended up being symbolic. The object of the search of the early alchemists was to satisfy their material needs, their intellectual capacities, and their spiritual yearnings. All three. The alchemists of the nobler sort always made the first of these objects subsidiary to the other two. Those who failed to understand the spiritual nature of alchemy were called puffers, fakers, whose only interest was to turn lead into gold. Freemasons called those who were pretenders or intruders cowens. In Vermont, there were those who were only looking for gold and failed to understand the spiritual dimension to the treasure-seeking impulse. Joseph Smith, I contend, was not one of these. He demonstrated a deep or profound understanding of the spiritual nature of the activity. His whole life story is about spiritualizing those things that others see as common. Early on in the prophet's ministry, he encountered the idea of human perfectibility. Just as any good alchemist or Freemason, He continued to develop the idea of divinization throughout his life. I hope this study has shown you another context in which we can regard Joseph Smith's treasure-seeking activities.
I don't have any slides, so we're good. Turn the light. Let there be light. So yeah, my name is Mike Reed. Hi, guys. I really find this field of study when it comes to the overlapping convergences of all things esoteric. It's really hard to study because for myself, I'm overwhelmed with the material that's out there, right? And so it is challenging, but it is also very fascinating. And in so exploring this, I end up being a treasure seeker myself. So my dissertation that I'm now currently working on, it relates to Islam, Catholicism, and Mormonism. It's about a set of plates that were found in Granada, Spain in 1600, found by treasure seekers, found in a sacred hillside. They were sealed records, buried with other relics. And these records claim that the people who were then being run off the land were introduced to Christianity beforehand. Right, and now these people were the Moors, right, in Granada, Spain. They were being kicked out, banished. And I think this is interesting because my parallel study with the gold plates is the Native Americans were being kicked out at the same time, right? The Indian Removal Act, didn't precede it, but it shortly after... It came into place, and so this parallel study, I think, is fascinating to me and how it overlaps so many things related to Mormonism, religion in general, occult studies, I even think Freemasonry, except I don't want to read too much into it. But that being said, there's been, in my study, other topics that I wanted to talk about, but didn't quite fit my dissertation, and this is one of them. And so I will start off this presentation by noting that when Joseph Smith was first informed, according to the church's official history, that he was informed by Moroni, a spirit or angel, depending on the account, but maybe it's one and the same, especially if you have a Swedenborgian understanding of spirits. So it is at this time that he realizes about this sacred treasure that's built in this hillside. But what does Moroni quote to him, aside from letting him know about this? Malachi, right. Quotes Malachi, which is actually, if you think about it, kind of strange. A little bit. I mean, it's certainly prophetic if you look at what happened later on in Mormon developments with regard to baptisms for the dead and all that, right? But he also, in addition to that, then also quoted a passage referring to Elias, who would restore the keys. And we also know about this, that these were important keys that were necessary for binding the ordinances that would carry on and to the next life, but then also bind people together, future and backwards, in the past. So what I suggest to you is that this was, being that Joseph Smith's discovery of these gold plates was already in this large context of Joseph Smith's family being involved in treasure seeking, I think this raises a question about treasure seeking itself and whether or not it was just a selfish endeavor to try and get rich or whatever, right? Or maybe it's about whether or not you can dupe other people so that you can have a following within your small circle. That's also possible. John L. Brooke has suggested that treasure-seeking quests were kind of used as a cover, and this is in his Refiner's Fire, excellent book, by the way, that this was sometimes used as a cover for counterfeiting. So, you know, I mean, if you think about it, if you're going to be a counterfeiter, right, well, how do you explain that you suddenly became wealthy, right? Well, if you're a treasure seeker, you have this narrative that totally makes it plausible unless you doubt the treasure-seeking narrative to begin with. So my argument is that treasure-seeking provided a consciousness for Joseph Smith. Now, we've heard Richard Bushman, Mark Ashurst McGee, right, talk about seer stones and about how these magical practices and treasure-seeking activities were things that that actually made it possible for him to become the prophet that he was. Now, personally, myself, my own belief is I don't believe in the foundational claims of Mormonism, but this narrative, I think, is interesting and something that we should still try and engage with. So the idea is that Joseph Smith, yes, he believed in pretty much everything that the thinking person shouldn't believe in, right? But because of this, he was so malleable, right? He was so open to possibilities that the most of us wouldn't even bother considering. And so Joseph Smith was a effective chosen person for the Lord because he was willing to believe so much to the expense of maybe believing too much, right? But it's an interesting thesis, right? And I think it's, again, something we should consider. But what I would also say is that with my position right now is that there's a kind of a apologetic twist that I think can be offered, right, to believers to see magical treasure seeking in a context that is beyond selfishness, beyond pride, beyond, because the thing is with treasure seeking, yeah, sometimes it was about trying to get rich, right, but what lies behind this is things like hauntings from ghosts, right? Whenever there was, in the modern and early modern, postmodern period, whenever there was a ghost or some strange sounds, right, people had their explanations, but the natural conclusion was that there's some unfinished business that needs to be done, right? We get this narrative even today in the movies that we watch, right? Maybe some ghost starts rapping on the walls or creaking around, and so then somebody, either themselves are able to have the blessed opportunity to see the spirit and talk to them, or they find a specialist who's able to do that, right, through some type of magical means or whatever. And so then they find out, they contact the spirit and they say, what do you want, right? what do we need to do in order for you to leave us alone, right? And sometimes it's something like, this ghost was deceased, person that had been murdered, right? And so the narrative is of this story is that they're supposed to find justice, bring this guy to court so he can be held accountable for the crime that he committed against this ghost. So in some ways, that is a proxy, view a little bit, right? And then if you even go further back to where there's really not so much many ghosts involved, sometimes there are, sometimes there aren't. But the idea of people being buried in inappropriate places, right? So sometimes we have ghosts or saints or some types of signs that come to these people, these spiritualists, and they are informed that they are buried in an incorrect location, but that they are to then go repatriate the grave, right? Or to dig up the grave and then provide a proper burial so that they can rest in peace, right? Because there's this understanding that if this isn't done first, they're not going to be experiencing peace, right? They're going to kind of be in this quasi-limbo state, can't go to hell if they're bad, which might be a good thing, right? Or can't go to heaven either, right? And so what ends up happening also is that if you're a believer of ghosts and spirits and hauntings and all that, right, there's this consciousness that is developed in the mind of these believers, and that believer's consciousness is about vicarious work for the dead. Even when it comes to, you know, maybe it's less spiritual or whatever, but we have these romantic legends of knights that have some comrade who was killed and buried inappropriately, and they need to provide honor for him. And so what do? You know, they're afraid that the wolves are going to come and rip him apart, right? Which is a bit ironic because at least a couple of them that I've read is they're worried about that these knights will be ripped apart, but then one of the swords of the knights has St. James's knuckle in it. Kind of ironic, right? That they're kind of ripping him apart. So just this idea of reburying the deceased is a vicarious work. And this is central to the narrative of Freemasonry, right? It's something that would provide provide ideas that can lead to a more developed consciousness when it comes to vicarious work for the dead. Now, I've rattled on too much, but Mormons have tended to regard the activity of treasure seeking as a selfish endeavor. I offer that we should look at these activities with an additional view, not necessarily to contradict it or not, but something that I think deserves consideration. For many modern and postmodern people of the period, when we had these hauntings, there developed this idea that there was a treasure nearby, right? How much am I on time? Okay, we're good. That there was a treasure nearby and that they were stuck there. So what ended up happening is when people would speculate and try and come up with these ideas in a certain neighborhood, right? Trying to find these certain narratives that they may have already experienced to try and explain why these hauntings are happening. And it often was the conclusion that there must be a treasure nearby. And when it comes to treasure seeking, sometimes when you explore or try to retrieve these treasures, there can be some danger involved, right? Because maybe it's not just a nice spirit, right, that was forced to be there to guard the plates because a curse was imposed on them, right? But sometimes there was also, or sometimes there was only an evil spirit or the devil, right, that's guarding it. Sometimes there's the good spirit, but then you got the devil that's babysitting and making sure that he stays and fulfills his responsibility. And so with this mindset, it's there's a risk. So you go into it partly because you want the money, right? But also partly because you are concerned about the salvation of this spirit who was buried in the location, maybe, or at least the spirit was there because it is his responsibility quite possibly against his choice to guard it. And so he's stuck in a limbo space, can't move on to heaven. And so the treasure seeker, his responsibility is not only to locate the treasure, but his responsibility is then to bind the treasure, right? Kind of like these binding powers that we got from Elijah, right? These types of powers were not only to fix the treasure in the spot so that it's not slippery, right? We hear about slippery treasures in the Book of Mormon. They actually, this was part of treasure lore, is that if you don't do things correctly, in the right order, in the right ways, they'll slip from your hands. And so it was important to bind the treasure to the spot. But then also, especially if there were evil spirits that were involved in guarding this treasure, they needed to guard, they needed to bind the spirit. Maybe not the good spirit that was there, but bind the bad one, right? And so in that process, there's this engagement. Sometimes there's a negotiation. Sometimes there's actually stories of them making an oath to be a disciple of Satan, right? But that might be the more extreme account. But there's often this negotiation that's involved, right, if there's an evil spirit. And sometimes there's a narrative, for example, about it being required for a Christian to be killed. And so they figured out a way to trick the devil, right? And what they did is they actually baptized a chicken, made it Christian, and then they killed the chicken, right? In some ways, it's kind of a vicarious baptism, right? A vicarious sacrifice as well, right? But the practices among treasure seekers, especially in Germany, of the modern period, but also in Pennsylvania, where there's a big, huge German presence, there's this idea that treasure-seeking activities involves piety to where they need to be worthy, right? So that they can be able to more effectively provide the salvation for these spirits who are trapped. And not only would they have these long fastings, these prayers, these songs, the hymns that are sung, right? They would also perform masses for the dead. Now, this was a Catholic practice, right? They would perform masses in behalf of the dead. They would pray in behalf of the dead. And sometimes these Masonic treasure seekers, or not Masonic, maybe they were Masonic, treasure seekers would actually offer vicarious partaking of the Eucharist. Now, a lot of people have said that, you know, Joseph Smith got this idea of treasure seeking from the Ephrata community or the Shakers that were in Lebanon and New York, right? And that very likely could be the case. Both of these movements were contemporaneous to Joseph Smith's day and were very close. Had very similar world views, it appears. But it doesn't have to be, because we already have these vicarious works, this vicarious consciousness that is developed just by Joseph Smith being so involved in treasure seeking that it would just take one step, right? You already have sacrifice for the dead. You already have prayers for the dead, singing hymns for the dead, Eucharist for the dead, sacrificing chickens, and then baptizing, or sacrificing baptized chickens. It wouldn't be a huge leap. So what I'm suggesting is that maybe we should reconsider those who hold to the theory that Joseph Smith got the idea from the Ephrata community or Shakers in Lebanon, New York, to be open-minded to other ideas, or even to explore those topics, but then see if you can apply the lens that I'm attempting to apply. For instance, we already know that they practiced baptisms for the dead, but did they practice treasure seeking? right? Because if it fits in this context that I had discussed already about this understanding, this worldview of vicarious work and the need, it would, I think, provide important information. And it turns out they did. They practiced both treasure seeking and baptisms for the dead. But I want to close. How much time do I have? About time, okay. 20 minutes, really? Oh, until we, okay. Okay, so we're hoping to have a question and answer session later. Okay. So, again, Germans in particular were major proponents of treasure seeking. I have some books to show you if you're interested, to discuss it afterwards if you're interested. But so in the 16th century, treasure hunters in Germany, there's a scandal that was happening. Two friends had convinced three men that there was a treasure that was hidden by a soul that had gone to purgatory. In order that the dead man is to leave this trap state, the treasure needed to be obtained. And so only when the soul had been freed would the demon that then guarded the treasure, and also apparently the soul too, would this salvation be provided. Now, he had a following, these two, and what he required is that they kind of put down a down payment of money first, right? 20 pounds. And that once they obtain the treasure, then everybody will get their share, right? Which is, of course, going to be way more than that. So now this is actually a common tactic that's used, especially by frauds, of treasure seeking, right? But what they did is they called it seed money. They called it seed money, right? So you plant it to get so much more, right? This actually is directly tied to also indulgences. What's that? Yeah, right, televangelism. But paying of indulgences, right, for the freeing of these people, these souls that are stuck in purgatory. Paying of indulgences, whether you believe in it or not, is an effort of vicarious, or is an effort for salvation for the dead. Okay, so these treasure seekers, what they did is they demanded that these two that I'm talking about just now, they demanded that people become more and more pious, demanded that they fast more than they had previously done before. The person's name, the leader, was named Walter, and his following, the company that he had, consisted of 9 men and 4 women. And what's interesting, though, is that this treasure-seeking specialist takes on the role of being not only charismatic, but also a religious leader, a priest, right? A prophet, even. And so what ends up happening with this movement in particular is it kind of turned into this quasi-religious group, kind of like we already heard about Nathaniel Wood with his New Israelites. Now, this precedes that, but I think it's a very complex converging of multiple currents that the Woods Great Movement of Nathaniel Wood drew inspiration from. Now, to give one last example of a movement that I think actually is pretty closely tied to not only the time period, not only the mindset, but also never mind. Okay, I'll just move on. Okay, this guy, the book is called, the author is called, or author's name is Dillinger, already cited. His book is titled Magical Treasure Hunting in Europe and North America. And what he does is he shows this, that treasure-seeking specialists who are the treasure wizards became spiritual advisors, priests, and prophets. Such religious figures found themselves providing over a congregation, but often these congregations were multi-denominational, which is kind of fascinating. And this specific group came during a time of religious strife where religions were breaking apart, people were fighting over. And so in some ways it kind of served like Freemasonry did, where it was a place for people to unite together despite them having different religious views. It was multi-denominational groups that they increasingly focused on bringing salvation to these bound spirits. One group in Wittenberg became very concerned with this idea in the 1770s. They were convinced that freeing the bound spirits depended on their own personal worthiness. And so they needed to fast, they needed to pray, they needed to repent of their own sins, to prepare themselves. And so they'd encourage this to happen. But by this being encouraged, it kind of brings them together as a religious community because people are doing things together. Now, in 1770, Marianne Freyen, she was the maidservant of this guy named George Buck. And he informed these people through the specialist, which was his maidservant, Freya, that she had seen some ghosts, a dark ghost that had dark skin, that he was stuck in this limbo state and couldn't receive salvation because he was trapped, right? And so he was appealing to the people of this movement. What ends up happening is it says that she somehow redeemed him. It doesn't say specifically what those acts entailed, but that redeemed him. And the narrative further goes along in saying that the dark angel had turned white. Which would, of course, symbolically indicate that there was a cleansing, a redemption that happened. But this spirit then, what's interesting is not only was it freed from this limbo state, but it kind of felt like it was very thankful for what had been done for him. And so there was this desire to, in gratitude, to bless this congregation. And so this spirit would bring another spirit along, and they would visit this congregation, and people were excited all around. People from all around the area would gather together on a regular basis to talk to these spirits. And the thing is with these spirits, they weren't just in a limbo state because they were redeemed, so they had an opportunity to go to heaven, right? Experience what it was like up there. And so then after that, coming down, they now had information that they can share to the congregation. And so what they did, the spirits, they provided hymns. They provided new revelations. And they compiled these, and they had their own scriptural canon, a volume of scripture that they actually considered to be greater than the Bible. Okay, I have so much more to talk about. Thank you for this opportunity to talk. Again, my thesis or my argument here that I hope to propose is, and I hopefully have, is that vicarious work for the dead is something that Joseph Smith would have learned about through his treasure-seeking activities, and that maybe we should not see treasure-seeking activities as such a selfish endeavor after all. Thank you.
We do have about 10 minutes left for questions. Make sure if you have a question to come up and speak into the mic so we can hear it on the recording. There doesn't appear to be a cordless one here. So make sure you come and say it into the mic and direct it at whoever you would like to answer your question.
So Jesus said, "The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure buried in a field, that when a man discovered it, he hid back up and then went and sold everything that he had so that he might obtain it." Matthew Henry's commentary on this says that the treasure wasn't like a bunch of coins, but because of the language that the text uses, that it's likely a mine. something that he later comes to work. That's why he hides it back up. It's not something he can carry away. It's something that he has to go to and work. So the allegory of treasure seeking, of digging for a treasure, originates in Christianity with Jesus himself and this allegory of the treasure in the field. I just wanted to point that out if you have a comment to make on that. There's something else, though. This idea of redemption being associated with seeking a treasure. Personal experience is that there is a practice that has to do with tikkun, right, with redemption or restoration, where you do a meditation that has to do with members of your family. So I have a meditation with my grandfather. Is there something in his life that if he were still here today, he's passed away, right? If there were something that I could do for him, something that I could do that would complete something that he began. And that had to do with a purchase of a home. You know, I benefited directly from this, I want to say. But this was his advice to me. And I went and I did that. So this idea that there are things that the living can do to assist the dead to complete the work that they were doing while they were living on the earth does not originate with Joseph Smith. It doesn't even originate with Christianity. It's ubiquitous in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And the Kabbalists are really, this is a really important part of the work that they do. And when we talk about the spirit of Elijah, what we're really talking about is a kind of reincarnation that occurs in Judaism, where the spirit of a great prophet, which is not a single, or not a unitary thing, it has levels, right? And one of the levels of the spirit is the prophet's consciousness that is engaged in a particular work that prophet was called to do. The spirit of Elijah refers to the part of Elijah that is called to do a particular work. And when Mormons say that they're doing the work of Elijah, they're completing the mission of a prophet who is now dead, right, in his behalf. It's vicarious work. I'm just pointing out that this tradition that Mormonism has strains in both Christian and Jewish tradition. And if any of you would like to speak on either of those subjects, I would love to hear it. Thank you.
So first of all, I wish that Joe had been speaking with us today. He's got a lot to add. But he's right about tikkun. That's one of the core principles of, well, Kabbalah from the beginning, but especially from the 16th century onward. And it's not just meditation. There's the idea that there are souls who are stuck because of something that they've done, or they've been reincarnated in a stone, in a leaf. The legend about Jews moving from Germany to Poland is that they were sent by God and they went to travel, and they came to a land called Poland, which in Hebrew means rest here. And they stopped under the tree, and when they prayed and sang their hymns, they rectified the souls who were stuck in the leaves. There's stories about going to the marketplace or somewhere, picking up a fish, reciting the proper blessing for food, and thus doing something that the person who was reincarnated in the fish could not do or forgot to do. And one of the great scholars of Kabbalah, Gershom Scholem, he wrote this, I'll just be brief. Every event in every domain of existence faces at once inwardly and outwardly, which is why Luria declares that worlds and all their externals are dependent on acts of religion, on the fulfillment of the commandments and meritorious deeds. So everything you do is going to aid someone else. So that's a major theme that I didn't touch upon, but it's there. Thank you.
Anyone else want to jump in? Okay. All right, so my question, I guess I could just direct to the whole panel, anybody that wants to chime in. I'm very interested in the wood scrape time period in Vermont, Rutland County area. And from the time that I've spent working and researching it, it seems that most of the contemporary witnesses at the time kind of give the catalyst to it being a man named Winchell, a counterfeiter, right there is what they nicknamed him, the counterfeiter, and they say that he was hiding from, you know, law officials at some point, said that he hid in William Cowdery's home and such at different times. So what I've been looking for is more background on him and see if maybe he, you know, where did he come from? I'm looking for more information. I'm kind of looking for like a missing link between maybe Kelpius movement and did Winchell come from that? Because it seems like he introduced many of these Rodsman New Israelite concepts to all these congregational, you know, members that were up there. And so do you have any information on that to kind of build on the background for this Winchell, alleged Winchell character?
Lots of people have been looking for a background on him, and I am not aware of any thing we have of him before he appears on the scene with Nathaniel Wood Group. But we do have references later on in Mormonism where people wonder if this is him who is appearing in Lucy's stories. He's a very elusive character, and many Mormon historians are looking into that. But as you say, we don't have any solid information. We just have little hints here and there of especially where he went after, but not before.
I'd encourage you to continue. There you are. To study and pursue the Wood Scrape movement or Jerusalem, a New Israelite movement. But there are many others. So what I would do is I would consider, you know, what is going on with Count Cogliostro, right, and his Egyptian rite, which implores Freemasonry, treasure seeking, and all that, right? Or Mesmer, right, who is not only a proponent that actually revives the use of the divining rod because he's somehow tapped into hypnosis, right? That he's kind of like the forefather of hypnotism, right? But he employed a rod and stuff, and so this is one of the reasons why treasure seeking became part. Became interesting again to people. It kind of legitimized it to where now, as we see from Mesmer, which is science, right, that there it really is this fluid that connects us all together to where we can use these magical instruments once again and hopefully have better success. But also Swedenborg, right? There's a Swedenborgian rite that's happening. I mean, that is developing. Swedenborg is a major influence with Freemasonry. He was very interested in spiritualism, necromancy, even though he might not call it necromancy, right? And a lot of these theories that are assumed by people who practice treasure seeking. Also Napoleon. Napoleon had his own Egyptian rite, right? And he even claimed to have discovered a book of gold. He had a book of gold. Let that sink in, right? He practiced the Egyptian rite. Now, allegedly, this book of gold they found deposited underneath some pyramid, right? Kind of like a hill, right? Yes, a man-made hill. So that would be something else to pursue. You know, esoteric Freemasonry is a big deal. And the thing is we don't really have these authoritative statements because they're deviant, right? And so there's so many authorities that are spending their time to condemn them and to suppress them and all that. But there are still sources out there. And I would see not only what you can find with Nathaniel Wood. I'm probably not answering your question as you would like, but I would just say I think it's a bigger project. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. Round of applause.